Imagine for a second, just put yourself in this scenario. You are trying to hold back a fully armored squad of riot police.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, you're staring down this totally impenetrable wall of like helmets and shields and tactical gear. The street is slick with rain. The air is just thick with tension. And your only weapons, I mean, your only lines of defense against all of this heavy state machinery are a pair of pink ballet shoes and a flimsy gray umbrella.
I mean, that sounds like an absolute tactical nightmare. It's a completely absurd, comical mismatch that would, never actually happen in real life.
Right. In the real world, it's a scenario that makes literally zero sense. But when you see that exact fragile scene translated onto a canvas, it somehow becomes one of the most striking, visceral visual declarations of social protest you could possibly look at.
Yeah, it really does.
It completely short circuits your brain's normal expectations of like what strength actually looks like.
It forces the viewer to recalibrate their entire understanding of power, right? Of
Yeah.
vulnerability and who actually holds the moral high ground in a conflict.
Exactly. So welcome to today's deep dive, where you and I are going to explore exactly that kind of visual recalibration. We are immersing ourselves in the work of artist Jero Duque.
A really fascinating artist.
Specifically, we're unpacking the chapter titled Protesta from his book Trastio, Pintura Artística, alongside his digital gallery, which is called No Luces Art Color Agua.
Right?
Our mission today is to figure out how an incredibly delicate, medium-like watercolor, something we usually reserve for painting, I don't know, serene sunsets or gentle botanical studies, how that can be weaponized.
Yeah, how just a few drops of water and pigment are being used to document raw civic resistance, forced migration, and, massive global crises.
But before we get into the aesthetics, I know we have some ground rules to cover.
Yes, absolutely. Before we delve into the aesthetics, I need to lay down a firm, completely non-negotiable ground rule for our discussion today.
Go for it.
The source material we are unpacking is heavily charged with very distinct, explicit political ideologies. Duke's text and artwork serve as a direct, unblinking attack on the neoliberal economic model.
It does not hold back.
Not at all. The book harshly criticizes the 2021 Colombian government, specifically labeling then-President Iván Duque as abusive and accusing his administration of operating through corrupt institutional structures.
Yeah.
And beyond Colombia, the artist also takes a definitive vocal stance on the geopolitical conflict in Palestine. So we must explicitly assure you, the listener, that in this deep dive, we are taking absolutely no political sides.
Zero.
We are not endorsing a left-wing agenda, a right-wing agenda, or the author's specific political viewpoint.
Exactly. We're looking entirely at the canvas. Our mission here is strictly to neutrally report, decode, and interpret the aesthetic and conceptual choices this artist used to document history as he processed it.
We are examining the mechanics of how intense political ideology is translated into visual art. Nothing more and nothing less.
So, with those rules of engagement firmly set, let's look at the backdrop where Duke's concept of active memory was actually born.
Right, let's set the scene.
The catalyst for this collection is the 2021 Colombian Estallido Social or social outburst. And just for a bit of context, this wasn't just like a weekend march.
No, definitely not.
This is a period of massive, paralyzing civic mobilization across the entire country.
Millions of people were in the streets for months. And the artist's text frames this uprising as a direct reaction to extreme economic inequality.
Right.
When he critiques the neoliberal model, he is referring to a system of privatization and austerity that, in his view, just pushed the working class to a breaking point during an already devastating global pandemic. The art is an attempt to capture that sheer desperation.
Which brings us right back to that ballerina image I mentioned at the start.
Yeah, that powerful visual.
The piece is titled Arte en Resistencia, and the atmosphere the artist creates is incredibly tense. You have this wet, slick asphalt reflecting a heavy, oppressive gray sky.
Very moody.
And in the background, there's the majestic, imposing silhouette of a cathedral. But the foreground is really where the narrative lives. On the left side of the painting, there is a dense, dark, geometric wall of riot police.
Yeah, and they have no facial features, right?
None at all. They're just pure intimidating machinery.
A monolithic wall of state authority entirely stripped of its humanity.
And standing on the wet pavement facing them are two ballet dancers on point.
Huh?
One is wearing a white tutu, the other is in black, holding that delicate gray umbrella against this wall of tactical gear.
Such an incredible image.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I have to push back a little on the reality of this framing.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, in the physical world, A ballerina with a rain umbrella standing against rubber bullets and tear gas is ballistically useless. I mean, it's essentially a death wish.
Right. Tactically, it makes no sense.
Exactly. Is the artist just leaning into heavy-handed theatricality for the sake of drama?
What's fascinating here is that the physical uselessness of the umbrella is actually the entire point.
Oh.
Yeah, the artist isn't trying to paint a literal tactical clash of forces. He is painting a symbolic one.
Yeah.
The painting frames that umbrella as invincible, but strictly in terms of moral superiority.
Ah, I see.
He is deliberately pitting the heavy, impenetrable machinery of the state against the most exposed anatomical fragility he can conjure. I mean, a dancer on point requires immense discipline and strength.
Right. It's brutal on the body.
Exactly. But it is a profoundly naked, human kind of strength. The theatricality strips away the chaotic noise of a riot and forces you to look at the sheer, terrifying disparity in power.
That isolated vulnerability is drilled into even further in a piece you pointed out from the gallery, La Razón de la Fuerza.
Yeah, that painting isolates the individual terror of these clashes perfectly.
Can you describe what's happening in that one?
Duke paints a lone, unarmed protester kneeling on the wet asphalt. One hand is raised up, completely empty, just pleading for a halt.
Just a totally exposed gesture.
Right. And towering over this fragile figure is a fully armored officer with a baton raised high in the air, captured just a fraction of a second before the strike lands.
Wow. It's like a freeze frame of impending trauma.
It really is.
But what really stands out in the book is how the artist doesn't just leave the subjects in a state of isolated victimhood.
No, the narrative evolves.
Right. Duke's narrative suggests that when citizens are crushed by that machinery, they eventually realize they have to organize. The individual vulnerability kind of gives way to collective defense.
We see that evolution clearly in a painting titled Puerto Resistencia.
That's the one in Cali, right?
Yes. This piece captures what was known in Colombia as the first line. These were groups of marginalized, impoverished youth who literally stood at the front of the protest to absorb the impact of the riot police.
A human barricade.
Exactly. Duke paints them gathered under a famous monument in the city of Cali, holding these improvised patchwork shields made out of scrap metal and old street signs.
It is a profound shift from the fragile ballerina to this hardened communal barricade.
And the artist manipulates the reality of that communal power in such a brilliant way in another piece called La Fuerza de la Razón.
How so?
Well, in this painting, the police are just gone. They are entirely erased from the canvas.
Wait, really? Just missing.
By removing the oppressor from the frame, the state isn't even given the dignity of being recognized.
Oh, wow.
The focus shifts entirely onto the collective dignity of the protesters. Duke paints this massive march of indigenous and peasant communities. They are holding traditional staffs of authority, and flying over the crowd are the bright red and green flags of the Regional Indigenous Council of Cauca.
Which is a hugely symbolic detail. I mean, the Creek represents historically marginalized indigenous communities.
Right.
Seeing their flags leading a massive urban protest is a powerful visual of people reclaiming their space in a society that, you know, the artist argues, has long ignored them.
It's reclaiming the narrative entirely.
But looking at all these street scenes brings us to a massive technical paradox in this collection.
The choice of medium.
Yeah. Here's where it gets really interesting. Because think about the subjects we've just been describing.
Very harsh subjects.
We're talking about heavy metal shields, wet asphalt, the burning sting of tear gas, the brutal crush of riot gear, and explosive urban tension. Yet the artist chose to document all of this using watercolor.
Right, which seems counterintuitive.
Using fluid, translucent watercolor to paint heavy riot gear and tear gas feels a bit like trying to carve a brutalist monument out of cotton candy.
That's a great way to put it.
Like, why use such a notoriously soft, unpredictable medium for such a hard, violent reality?
Well, the answer lies in the deliberate physical chemistry of the medium itself.
Okay, lay it on me.
In watercolor, water acts as an equalizer. Think about the mechanics of a street protest. Tear gas is deployed to blur the vision of the protesters, right? To create chaos and to dissolve their defensive lines.
Yeah.
On the canvas, Duke uses water to do the exact same thing to the state. The water diffuses and dissolves the rigid, authoritative, hard lines of the police shields.
That is wild.
It literally strips the state's machinery of its sharp, defined power right there on the paper.
So the medium itself is structurally rebelling against the subject matter.
Exactly. And watercolor is inherently chaotic. You lay down the water, You drop in the pigment, and it flows where it dictates.
It has a mind of its own.
It refuses to be perfectly controlled by the artist. That organic, sprawling unpredictability perfectly mimics the uncontrollable nature of a social uprising.
That makes total sense.
Furthermore, Duke is intentionally avoiding the clinical, bloody rawness you would get from a photograph.
Right, because a photo gives you the literal graphic violence.
Right. And a photograph of a riot often makes us focus on the gore or the action.
You get lost in the shock value.
Yes. The softness of watercolor forces the viewer's eye away from the trauma and onto the ephemeral fragility of the human subjects. It demands that you recognize their humanity first.
But the narrative of the book doesn't end when the tear gas clears.
Far from it.
Duke draws a very direct causal line from those streets to the borders. His argument is that when that collective resistance fails to change the system, when the economic pressure becomes entirely unlivable, citizens don't just go home.
No, they can't.
They are forced to flee entirely. The landscape of his art fundamentally shifts from urban barricades to desperate migration routes.
And the crisis of forced migration is perhaps where his technique becomes the most physically immersive. He really wants to destroy the safety of being a passive observer.
You feel that immediately in a painting called La Bestia.
Yes, the train.
Right. Named after the infamous Mexican cargo train that migrants ride on top of, literally risking their lives to reach the northern border. He doesn't paint the train passing by in the distance like a traditional landscape painting.
No, the perspective is totally different.
He places the vanishing point directly on the corrugated metal roof of the train. You are physically placed on top of the moving train, looking down the length of the cars.
It conveys the literal dizzying vertigo of sitting on a moving train roof, but it also captures the existential vertigo of displacement.
Yeah, that sense of having nothing to hold on to.
You feel how precarious their survival is in that exact moment.
But I want to push back a highly specific technical detail in another migration piece.
Okay, which one?
The painting is 330 immigrants, which depicts these faceless silhouettes trying to cross the Darien Gap, that notoriously brutal, roadless stretch of jungle between Colombia and Panama.
A very harrowing crossing.
In the text, the artist emphasizes that this piece is painted on Arches 640-gram cold-pressed rough grain paper.
Yes, a very specific choice.
Now, I understand that 640 grams means the paper's incredibly thick, essentially like a heavy piece of cardboard. But if I'm just standing in a gallery looking at a painting on a wall, why does the literal physical weight and microscopic texture of the paper actually matter to this story?
It matters deeply because the physical material becomes a tangible metaphor for the environment and a weapon against digital amnesia.
Okay, I'm listening.
When paper is 640 grams and has a rough grain, the surface isn't flat. Microscopically, it is full of tiny jagged valleys and crests, like a harsh topographic map.
Right.
When Duke applies dark, heavy watercolor to that specific paper, the pigment doesn't glide smoothly. It settles heavily into those deep microscopic valleys, and it leaves the crests exposed.
So it looks gritty.
It creates a visual texture that is raspy, turbid, and physically hostile to the eye.
So the paper itself mirrors the physical hostility of the jungle they are walking through.
Exactly. But there is a second, even more profound layer.
What's that?
The source reference for this painting was a fleeting digital photograph he found online, an image that most of us would just swipe past on our phones.
Oh, wow.
An image served up by a social media algorithm, consumed for 3 seconds, and then just erased from our mind.
We do that every day.
By taking that specific disposable digital image and spending days agonizingly painting it by hand onto incredibly heavy, expensive, textured cotton paper, the artist is launching a protest against mass desensitization.
He is giving that 3-second tragedy literal physical weight.
He is making the suffering permanent. He is refusing to let the algorithm erase these people. And it's crucial to note that this specific work is slated for exhibition in Palma, Spain in late 2024.
Really? Why Spain?
He is intentionally forcing European audiences to stand in a physical room and confront the heavy physical texture of this pain rather than just swiping past it on a screen from the comfort of their homes.
It requires the viewer to actually sit with the discomfort. And looking at the next section of the book, I mean, you really do have to take a deep breath before turning the pages.
It gets much heavier.
This mechanism of anchoring ignored suffering leads the deep dive beyond regional borders entirely. The artist expands his concept of protest from civic discontent in Colombia and the migration trails of the Darien Gap all the way to the denunciation of international war crimes.
He takes that same aesthetic of fragility and applies it to the devastation in Palestine.
The emotional weight of these pieces is staggering. There's a painting called 342 El Mundo Mira, The World is Watching.
Yes, a very difficult piece.
It shows a mother screaming toward the sky with a lifeless child in her arms. Surrounding her are other children, and they have these completely empty, frozen stares of extreme, incomprehensible trauma.
What is structurally brilliant about that piece is the use of color. Duke uses a flat, suffocating gray for all the surrounding rubble.
It really washes out the background.
That aesthetic choice actively forces the viewer's eye away from the destruction of the buildings and locks it entirely onto the remaining color and humanity of the victims in the foreground.
Wow.
He won't let you get distracted by the architecture of war. You have to look at the human cost.
And there is another piece, Far, where he uses perspective, just like he did with the cargo train.
Oh, yes.
You are positioned behind two small children inside a bombed-out building. You are looking over their tiny shoulders out at a blazing, burning city. And the whole scene is historically anchored by just one detail, a fragment of the Palestinian flag buried in the rubble at their feet.
It grounds the universal theme of childhood trauma in a very specific, undeniable geopolitical reality.
Right.
The book also weaves in broader historical context, like the piece Noento, which depicts 20th century class struggles. Duke is demonstrating that the fight against systemic oppression is a continuous historical through line.
But I have to admit, as I was reading through these sources, I hit a massive wall.
How so?
Because after exploring the heavy reality of bombed children in the Middle East and brutalized protesters in Colombia, there's a sudden, highly unexpected pivot in the artist's book.
Ah, yes, the animal rights section.
Out of nowhere, there is a harsh critique of bullfighting and a passionate plea for interspecies ethics. So what does this all mean?
It's a big shift.
I have to ask a genuinely challenging question here.
If you
group bomb children in a war zone and marginalized protesters being beaten in the streets alongside a protest against a bullfight, doesn't that massively dilute his entire political message?
That's a fair question.
Doesn't equating animal suffering with literal war crimes severely weaken the gravity of the human victims he just spent the whole book elevating?
It's a very natural reaction to feel a sense of dissonance there. It feels jarring, for sure. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, we can decode the philosophical framework the artist is operating within.
Okay, I'm open to it.
Duke isn't saying that a dying bull is identical to a bombed city. He isn't equating the two events on a literal one-to-one scale. Rather, he is targeting the root psychological cause that allows both to happen in the first place.
So he's diagnosing the underlying disease, not just looking at the different symptoms.
Exactly. He is proposing what we might call a unified spectrum of violence. His argument is that a society that normalizes the torture of a living animal for entertainment and dresses it up as tradition or culture is actively eroding its own baseline thresholds for empathy.
Wow, okay. That's a strong argument.
Once that basic foundational empathy collapses, once a society can sit in a stadium, watch suffering, and applaud it, it becomes psychologically much easier for that same society to justify displacing marginalized communities.
Or to rationalize bombing civilians for geopolitical gain.
Exactly. Because the collective muscle of compassion has already been allowed to atrophy.
That is a fascinating way to look at it.
The artist is demanding a totalizing defense of life. He is demanding that we feel compassion for suffering, period, regardless of biological species or national borders. It is a strict refusal to compartmentalize our empathy.
When you reframe it like that, it actually strengthens his previous pieces. It challenges the viewer to figure out where they have drawn their own arbitrary lines of who deserves compassion and who doesn't.
It turns the canvas into a mirror, really. It forces the audience to confront their own desensitization.
Which brings us to the end of an incredible thematic arc today. What started out as a simple analysis of water, pigment, and paper revealed itself to be a highly complex mechanism for fixing collective memory.
A huge journey.
We journeyed from the wet, tear gas-filled pavement of Colombia to the dizzying metal roofs of cargo trains rushing toward the border to the gray, suffocating rubble of the Middle East.
Through the unpredictability of watercolor, the artist manages to distill massive, overwhelming geopolitical realities into these very intimate, universal micro-moments of bravery and loss.
Really nice.
He forces the viewer to pause and engage with realities they might otherwise scroll past.
And for you listening, this matters today because this deep dive fundamentally challenges how we consume the world around us. It challenges how we categorize, how we scroll, and ultimately, how we so easily ignore the daily injustices that flash across our screens every single minute.
It asks us to confront the heavy physical texture of reality rather than just settling for the disposable digital ghost of it.
And that leads me to a final thought I want to leave you with. Something to mull over that builds on everything we've explored today regarding memory and media consumption.
Let's hear it.
I want you to examine your own mental canvas. Right now, we live in an era where our brains are subjected to an endless algorithmic flood of tragic headlines and fleeting digital images. They appear, we feel a microsecond of pity, and then we swipe them away into the void.
Too often.
How do you choose to weigh down the important truths in your own life? If an artist is willing to use heavy, 640-gram rough-grain paper to meticulously paint a tragedy just so it won't float away into digital oblivion, what is your personal equivalent?
That's a brilliant question.
Are you allowing the fast-paced clinical machinery of modern life to build rigid, impenetrable walls of indifference around you? Or are you deliberately allowing the slow, unpredictable water of empathy to soften your edges and anchor your humanity?
It's a lot to think about.
It's a heavy question, but one absolutely worth carrying with you today. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, and we'll catch you on the next one.